Jesus ends his Sermon on the Mount with this parable. He tells us, everyone who hears these words of mine, who has heard the sermon, these teachings, and acts of them, will be like a wise man who built his house on a rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall, because it had been founded on solid rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. You know what's interesting? Jesus does not instruct us to believe in his teachings. He instructs us to act on his teachings. That is his final statement about his Sermon on the Mount. These aren't just things to believe in. They are things to act on, principles to apply. Sometimes we get the idea that belief alone is all that it takes. If we hold the right thoughts, if we have great enough faith, that fills the bill. But here Jesus is suggesting that these are not just things to believe in. They are things to do. If we know these things, blessed are we if we do them. And that's kind of a different take on things. It seems to me he's suggesting that his teaching should be regarded, well, kind of like tools. If I have a picture to be hung, I believe a hammer and nail are the proper tools to get the job done. And that faith is justified, isn't it? They are the right tools for the job. But you know, when it comes to hammers and nails, simply believing in them isn't going to get the picture up, is it? I can have total faith in the ability of a hammer and nail to accomplish that task, but will that faith alone get my picture hung? Nor would I put a hammer and nails up there on the altar, prostrate myself before them, and beg them to hang my picture. Because no matter how sincere or pitiful my begging, I just don't think that would work. That doesn't mean my faith in hammers and nails is unjustified. They are the proper tools. But tools have to be used to get results. Tools have to be used. You have to drive the one in the wall with the other, and at the risk of whacking your thumb a time or two in the process. And the more out of practice you are, the more likely it is your thumb's going to get whacked. But I have found if you drive enough nails and hang enough pictures, you'll eventually get good at it. You'll hit the nail right the first time and won't bend it. You'll find the stud and it won't just push through the sheetrock. You'll get them level. Won't have to replace them. And your thumb will come out of the whole thing better and better. And I believe Jesus is telling us we ought to think of his teachings kind of in the same way. Think of God's truth kind of in the same way, that they are tools. Tools that will set us free. Tools that we can hang our lives on. And we should have faith in them, but it should be sufficient faith to actually apply them in our lives and not just think about it. Because I think, as Christians and truth students, that's what we do a lot of the time. We're not really truth students, we're not really Christians, we're just kind of thinking about it. As though just thinking about it is enough. Now, this is nothing new. The idea that we might be somewhat, well, let's say, that we might be better Christians and truth students in theory than we are in practice is something that really goes all the way back to the beginning of Christianity. Addressing the earliest Christians, the very first Christians, James wrote, "Be doers of the word and not merely hearers who deceive themselves." And again, "Those who look into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and persevere, being not hearers who forget, but doers who act, they will be blessed in the doing." And yet again, what good is it, my brothers and sisters, if you say you have faith but do not have works? Can faith alone save you? If a brother or sister is naked and lacks enough food to get through the day, and one of you says to them, "Well, why don't you just keep warm and find something to eat?" What help would that be if you do not also supply for these bodily needs? What good is that? To just wish someone well and not even attempt to do anything about it. So faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead. But someone will say, "You have faith, I have works." Well, James challenges us. He says, "Well, okay, show me faith apart from your works, and I, by my works, will show you my faith." Do you catch what he's saying? What he's saying is, if you want to know where your faith really is, not just the faith you aspire to, but where your faith is right now, look at what you're doing. If you are meeting life's challenges in a spirit of hope and optimism, rather than running away from them in a spirit of fear and doubt, that demonstrates the kind of faith you have. If you're doing it the other way, well, that's where your faith is today. If we look at what we do, it's sort of like what did they used to call it in the 70s? It's biofeedback. Life is our biofeedback machine. Life shows us where our faith is currently. And if we don't like how we're living it, then maybe if we live it different, we will uplift our faith a little bit. Because if we're not acting on it, how much do we really believe it? We may want to believe it. We may aspire to that faith. We may think about it for a long time. But do we really have it yet? Finally, he writes, "Just as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is also dead." Now, don't get me wrong. This does not mean that God sends his blessings as a reward for our good deeds. We don't get points for our good deeds. We don't earn God's blessings through our good acts. Because God's blessings don't need to be earned. They have no price. They are gifts. But gifts have to be unwrapped, tried on, worn, used to be appreciated, not just left in the box. And I think a lot of times we sort of leave our spirituality in the box. We're like someone that bought something they saw on TV, and they got it, and they looked at the box, and there's always these wonderful pictures on the box, aren't there? Pictures of happy people using whatever the thing is that we saw advertised for 30 minutes early in the morning or late at night. And they just seem to be having a wonderful time with what's in the box. And it seems to be just changing their lives for the better. Their house is clean, their shoes are shined, their dinner is cooked, whatever it does, I mean, it just does it great in the picture in the box. And there's captions. It even tells us how wonderful this thing in the box is. But you know, if you open the box, you know what's going to happen, don't you? If you open the box, you're not going to see what's in the picture. You're going to see something that consists of all the parts it takes to make the thing in the picture. You're going to find something that has some assembly required. And we're not always sure we're going to be able to follow those directions or find all the parts or have the right tools. And we might have to call that 800 number and wait forever and ever to get somebody to explain it to us. And even after we get them, we may not understand them or go to the website. So we think, well, this picture is so nice. I'll stick with that. There's no challenge in just looking at the picture. But you know what? There's also no reward to just looking at the picture and reading the captions. The only way you get the reward is by doing the required assembly. If we never take the Christ truth out of the box, what good is it to us or anyone else? And how much of it is really going to stick with us? We can read and read and study and talk about it till we get hoarse. But nothing is going to change our lives or even be lasting. Because in this life experience, well, you know what they say, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. Well, my dad was a good example of that. German was my father's first language. Not because he was born in Germany, he was born right here in St. Louis. But like a lot of people of his generation, born around the beginning of the 20th century, he grew up in a home where only German was spoken. Where his mom and dad only spoke German around the house, where they read a newspaper that was printed in German, where they even went to a church where the sermons were all preached and the Sunday school lessons were all taught to the children, auf Deutsch. German was all Dad heard as a child, so growing up, when he was a little boy, he spoke German better than he spoke English. Because he heard so much of it. He was immersed in the German language in over his head. And that would have actually been okay if they lived here in South St. Louis. But Grandpa got a really good job as a foreman of a brickyard. A drive around St. Louis will show you what big business brickyards were all through the 20th century. Grandpa got a real good job as a foreman in a brickyard up in North St. Louis. And up in North St. Louis, in the neighborhood where they moved the family, being the German kid made Dad different. Made Dad kind of an oddball. And then something terrible happened. Our family took it personally. World War I broke out and brought with it a lot of anti-German sentiment and made my dad not only the oddball German kid, it made him the target of nonstop bullying. It made him the Hun. And that wasn't short for honey. It was not a term of affection. It was an insult. And Dad was getting beat up. They couldn't let him out of the house. And so Grandma and Grandpa saw no alternative. They just decided they had to forbid Dad from ever speaking German outside again. And to pull this off, they themselves stopped ever speaking German at home. Oh, once in a while, even when the two of them were pushing 100, when they thought no one else was around, they'd speak German to each other. But it was always like it was their little secret. And we like to think they were being affectionate with each other, but with Grandma and Grandpa, one never knew. Could have gone the other way. But they obviously did not want us to know what they meant. But for Dad, it was like moving to a foreign country. My dad, who from infancy had been immersed totally in one language, was now suddenly baptized in another. Pushed down over his head and held down in a world where only English was spoken. Where English was spoken in the neighborhood, English was spoken at the shops, where they read a newspaper in English, where they switched and started going to a church where the sermons were preached in English, where they listened to radio programs in English, where the public school was taught in English, or at least what passes for English here in St. Louis, because I visited England a couple years ago, and I would assume they speak English there, and it's something totally different from what we speak here. Trust me, I could barely be understood in London. But at any rate, what happened was obvious. Dad, for whom German was a first language, gradually lost it. He lost it little by little at first, I'm sure. First the words, then his accent, until finally, late in my dad's life, his entire German vocabulary consisted of the word Gesundheit. That was the only German word he still said with any regularity and at the appropriate time. Other than that, he didn't speak any German. But you know what? I'll bet if Dad had ever had the opportunity to live in Germany for a while, to spend some time, maybe a year, someplace where he was once again immersed in German, I bet that first language is still down there somewhere. I bet it would have reemerged. It would have taken work. But if once again, everywhere he turned, they were speaking German, like in his childhood, I bet it would come back and he'd pick up German a whole lot faster than someone that, for whom it wasn't the first language. I bet a lot of it would come back to him. Because it was his first language, or, well, actually, maybe German was Dad's second language. Because I believe all of us came to Earth fluent in another language, the language of spirit. I think that's why when we read scripture or some inspirational book, some truth book, when we hear someone preach a sermon or read a daily word, something in us responds. I think there's something deep down in us that still understands that language. We may not exactly comprehend it yet. It may be slumbering in us and just barely waking up, just barely opening its eyes. But something deep down there, it's saying, hey, that sounds familiar. I've heard that word before. I know, I kind of know what it means. I think that's why we respond. So we may have seemed to have lost our spiritual fluency through disuse. But I believe it will come back. I don't think it's ever really lost. It's just kind of dormant. But it'll only come back if we immerse ourselves in it, if we start to use it. And you know, in learning a new language, especially if you're in a country where that's all they speak, it takes some daring to try to communicate. You can be a little timid, a little afraid. You'll say the wrong thing or say it in the wrong way and embarrass yourself or offend someone. It takes courage to break the silence, to try to speak. And you won't do it perfectly at first any more than you'll drive a nail perfectly the first time. But I have found people are very helpful. I have found you will find other people who speak the language of spirit. And they will encourage you, not laugh. And if you dare to take those first stumbling steps, your spirituality will awaken, just as a first language will awaken. But it will do it in the same way, through use. Through use. Jesus began his Sermon on the Mount by telling us we came to earth like the light of the world, but our light hidden under a bushel. The purpose of his sermon is to show us how to get that bushel off and let that light out so it shines for everyone. And to do that, I think it just means we need to think about his teachings in a different way. Not as things to just believe in, or to contemplate, or to think about, but as tools to use in our daily life. Our faith is a tool to give us the courage to step out. Our love as a tool to give us the courage to embrace someone and forgive someone. Our inspiration as a tool to use to give us the sense to follow that inner voice and not have to, with regret, look back knowing something told me to do differently. The truth will set you free. It really will. But if you know it, it will only set you free if you follow through on it. Because Christianity isn't just something to think about. Christianity is something to do and be. Let's pray about this. And to center ourselves for the experience of God in prayer, let us know that God's real presence is here with us and within us. At this very moment, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in our lives, God the good, omnipotent. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God the good, omnipotent. And so it is.